Pop Culture Affidavit, episode 156. Faster, higher, stronger. And welcome to episode 156 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that looks at everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Panarese. And just as this episode is coming out in late July, over in Paris are the Summer Olympics. And if you listen to my special series called Fallen Walls, Open Curtains, I did an entire episode on the Olympics, at least as far as it was concerned, the Cold War. I've been a fan of the Olympics for decades, so I wanted to devote an entire episode to it, talking about the sports, the athletes, the moments, as well as maybe some of the merchandising and pop culture associated with it. But I'm not alone in my quest for podcasting gold here. Let's be serious, though. I'd get at least maybe a bronze at best. Along with me is the host of the Quarterbin podcast for Alan's Eyes and Ears, and the co-host of Shortbox Showcase with M. Please welcome Professor Alan.
Hello. Thank you, Tom. I understand that you tried to record an earlier version of this podcast with Shag. But after he spent 3.5 hours talking about every member of Brazil's women's beach volleyball team, you had to pivot to me. I totally understand that. I appreciate the call up.
I don't own an audio board, but if I did, there would just be a button. She's hot. She's hot. She's hot. How are you?
Oui, oui, monsieur. Sacre bleu. Eiffel Tower.
Off the real. Oh. I can't imagine the French could get even interested enough to host the Olympics, but there, here we are.
Oh.
No, I love Paris, actually. I went there on my honeymoon back in 2003, so I've always wanted to go back, but life has other things in store for you. International travel is not on the docket when you have to help pay for your child's college education at some point. So,
trust me, buddy, at some point they graduate, they move out, they pay their own bills.
God, hopefully sooner rather than
a glorious feeling.
And honestly, I don't expect anything in return. Just enjoy your life. this is dropping right around the time of the opening ceremonies, which is the very end of July. And as everybody knows, it's about 16, 17 days of competition and ceremony and everything covered on NBC as well as some of its cable networks. What I'm going to do is just start by kind of giving an overview of the Olympics, and then you and I are just going to go into our origin stories and things that we remember about certain years and stuff. And I'm sure that there are some years that stand out like way, way more than others and stuff. So, excuse me. If you know anything about the Olympics, you know that they did originate in ancient Greece, with a few, more than a few sports that are actually in play today. I know that wrestling was a big one, discus, javelin, and some of the track events go back to the ancient times. Best estimate, at least according to my crack research using Wikipedia, is that they started sometime around the 8th century BCE and ended around sometime roughly in the 4th century CE. It was ended according to Wikipedia. And again, this is kind of a fruit dispute because it's the ancient world, so there's only so many records. But supposedly it was ended by the Romans because of conversion to Christianity and the prohibition of pagan festivals, which is what the Olympics were. And that would put it somewhere in like the 4th century or so.
Sure, Tom. Blame it on me and Stella. It's always the Christians. I see where this is going.
Well, I'll blame it on Stella. She's the Latin teacher.
A double whammy.
So in 1896, the Olympics are revived and they are held in Athens. There's summer games in Athens. And then in 1924, we have the first Winter Olympics, which take place in Chamonix, France. The games, of course, you know, and this is some information that if you have a pulse in this country, you understand them. The games are held every 4 years. And up until 1994, or 1992, they were held every 4 years in the same year. And then there was the 1994 Winter Olympics in Lillehammer, Norway, which reset the whole thing to be every 2 years there's an Olympic Games, winter and summer alternating. So, which I guess helps kind of keep the Olympic cycle going. I don't remember what the impetus behind that was. Aside, there's probably money involved in
the answer to all your questions, yeah. Tom, is money.
Yeah.
But I'm only going to say this once, but this is a fact that might impact our differing views on some of this. But the fact is that you are a young, inexperienced pup. Lacking the extra life experience that I possess, let's just put it that way. And so I lived like a decade longer than you did,
yes, you did.
At least with them being in the same year.
Mm.
And, you know, that was part of my sort of growing up Olympic expectations. But I love the fact that they're alternating now, because back in the old days, you'd have two, you know, 6 months apart maybe. Then it'd be 3.5 years.
Yeah.
But I like now where it's, you know, a year and a half, basically, and then 2.5 years. They just, again, that rhythm to them is much more, every even number year, there's some kind of Olympiad.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that this current schedule totally works for me.
I think it also helps put the Winter Games in the spotlight a little more because,
that's true.
I want to say that if you have, when they had them in the same year, the Summer Games were the more marquee event. So by having them every year of the year and having the Winter Games on their own, you can put some real, put some real spotlight on it.
Yes, sense of those being overshadowed beforehand. I think you're probably right there. Yeah.
So we're heading into Paris in 2024. The last games for the summer were actually held in 2021 in Tokyo. They had been delayed because of the COVID lockdown in 2020. And then I believe Beijing, China was the – and that region of China was the 2022 Winter Games most recently. The Olympics have been hosted on every single continent except for Africa and Antarctica. The United States has hosted the most Olympic Games in 9 total. France is second on that list with 6. Beijing is the only city to host both the Summer and the Winter Games. They held the Summer Games in 2008 and then the Winter Games in just 2022. There are several host cities that have repeated. The most repeated in the Winter Olympics were all twice. That's Lake Placid in New York, St. Moritz in, I want to say, is Switzerland or France? No, I think it's France. Innsbruck in Austria and Milan, Carterra, which will be hosting the games in 2026. So that'll be their second time. They hosted it way back, I think, in the 20s or early 30s. The Olympics has only been interrupted and not played at all for 3 of the 4 year cycles, because it was interrupted in 2020, but those games did go on in 2021. But in 1916, the games were canceled due to the First World War. And then 1940 and 44, they were canceled because of the Second World War. And of course, we can talk a little bit about this if we want to, but their politics and the world outside have sometimes played a part in the game's story. Moscow and LA, I talked about on Fallen Walls Over Curtains because the U.S. boycotted the Moscow Games in 1980 due to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 79. The Soviets turned around and boycotted the Los Angeles Games as a response in 1984. Other ones of note, Atlanta in 1996, of course, had was not completely overshadowed, but there was the bombing in the Olympic Park Richard Jewell was the name of the person who saved a few people and then got kind of scapegoated for it or blamed for it. And there was a whole, they eventually found out that the person who did it was, and I don't remember their name, but they were some sort of like, basically kind of like a Ted Kaczynski type, like from the woods and stuff, who had a record going back there. In Munich in 1972, before the games happened, you had the hostage situation with, I believe, members of the PLO taking the Israeli part of the Israeli Olympic team hostage and then killing a number of them. And going back even further to 1936, the Olympics were held in Berlin and were overseen, of course, by the then head of state of Germany, who was Adolf Hitler. Those, of course, were famous for being the games in which Jesse Owens won all of his medals and really showed up the Nazi kind of vulgar display of Nazi power that was going on in there. And in fact, you can we're going to talk about documentaries and stuff later. One of the more famous documentaries about the Olympics is the Leni Riefenstahl documentary about the 1936 Olympics. I've never actually seen it, but you do have to mention it, though. So that pretty much covers the kind of rundown of facts and figures about the Olympics. Our real purpose here is to just talk about what we love about the games and our memories of them and things. You, of course, having that decade on me, have more memories of it and such. So, sir, because I need to address my elders respectfully.
The good thing is, good thing is, in a few years, you'll probably start having more memories of these than I do, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes. So what is your first – what was your first Olympics? What are your first memories?
Yeah, I've just a few memories from Munich 72, sort of the primary – it sort of the sports-related one would have been the 7 gold medals. Mm-hmm. For U.S. swimmer Mark Spitz. Yeah. That was a big deal, not just sports-wise, but a big deal – U.S. culture-wise. I also think I have a vague recollection that there was something else newsy happening, although, you know, that memory might just be, you know, that might not be a memory. That might be just something I'm reflecting back on 72, learning about those events years later. Mm-hmm. I did write a research paper on the murdering of the Israeli athletes. It must have been high school. But again, I do want to say that whether it's Jim McKay or Peter Jennings or whoever it may have been, I think I have a feeling that I remember that they were taking time to talk about things other than the sports during the 72 broadcast, though I had no concept for really what that was, which means 1976 Montreal should have been prime time for me to really get involved in the Olympics, but we were living overseas at the time in Thailand. Oh. And so TV coverage, let's just say, not quite the same as it would have been. Although living in a foreign country certainly, you know, gives you a different perspective on sports and athletes, especially a country as small as Thailand without the athletic, you know, heritage.
Yeah.
Historically, Thailand has had success internationally in badminton and boxing. And we'll say to this day, nearly 50 years later, I still have a soft spot for the country, and I do root for the Thai athletes when they show up at the games. So the first ones that I would have been all in on would have been 1980, and obviously, you know, Lake Placid, being as dramatic as it was certainly. The first one to really you know, bring in those memories. And of course, thanks to Al Michaels, I do believe in miracles.
Yeah, I am just too young to remember that, because I would have been two and a half. So all of my memories of that have been watching it on through documentaries and on replay. You can watch like the whole game. Right. You can watch that whole game on YouTube if you want to. My first memories are of the 84 Los Angeles Olympics. I may have vague memories of Katarinovic winning in Sarajevo and maybe Torval and Dean. It sounds familiar, but then again, it's like, do I remember that, or is it because I saw so many different retrospectives and things on those people?
Right, because that's Olympic lore.
So that, do I remember that? But I do very much remember parts of the opening ceremony of the Los Angeles Games, especially when they would play. Were playing toward the beginning of it. They were playing, I believe, the John Williams Olympic Fanfare, which is my favorite piece of Olympic music. And the audience all had cards under their seats or whatever, and they were putting the cards up, and the cards all formed the flags.
Right,
I have a very vivid memory of watching that. I think I watched bits and pieces of it when my parents were watching it. Again, I can't tell you whether or not I saw Mary Lou Retton, or if I just was – I was certainly aware of Mary Lou Retton as we went through the years. I do remember bits and pieces of some of the track and field stuff. The marathon, I do remember seeing a little bit of it. I think I might have watched some of the closing ceremonies. But my first, like, full-on Olympic year would have been 88. I watched a lot of the Calgary games, especially the hockey. The starting defenseman on the 88 U.S. Olympic hockey team was Brian Leetch, and the goalie was Mike Richter, both of whom would play on the 1994 Stanley Cup champion New York Rangers. Richter was the goalie, and Leetch won the Conn Smythe Trophy. So I had known them since back in the those years. And I remember watching, oh God, Debbie Thomas and Katarina Witt and stuff in the women's figure skating. And then just watching, like, had no idea who half the athletes were, but I'd watch like skiing. You know, just like, and we'll get to another person later on, and we talk about some of our favorite moments in speed skating. But as we went on, like, you know, years and years and years later, I just started watching it every time it was on. And then I remember the Seoul Olympics of 88 pretty vividly. I do remember vividly the Ben Johnson controversy with anabolic steroids.
And Carl Lewis,
and then some of the other stuff there. So
I mean, that race has one of the all time iconic photographs, where it's Carl Lewis sort of looking to his side and seeing Johnson in front of him, and just can't believe what he's seeing.
Yeah. The other, I think, most photographed person at those games was Florence Griffith Joyner.
Oh, sure.
Flojo was amazing to watch too, because I remember watching her, and of course they licked the nails and everything, but like, it wasn't a case of here's a good looking athlete with like style and everything. She was dominant as well, so, and that was like really, really cool to watch. I think one of her records, if not still stands, stood for a very, very long time. In fact, the one of the oldest Olympic records, if I'm not mistaken, is the long jump. Because I don't remember who currently owns it. It's an American, and he beat it at the World Championships. But Bob Beamon's 1968 in Mexico long jump record still holds up as the Olympic record for the long jump. And I want to say that's like one of the longest standing. It's kind of like DiMaggio's streak at this point. Like, who is going to beat this thing?
And what I like about Beamon is that, to me, that has become a sports phrase. Mm-hmm. It's like, not when you just pass a record, but when you put it so far seemingly out of reach. You know, you've Beamoned something.
Yeah.
You know, these days, Katie Ledecky doesn't win gold medals. She Beamons. She Beamons those races, right? She's, you know, half a pool ahead of anybody.
She is insane to watch. was watching the trials the other night, and she's still, this is like
not fair.
This is like her third Olympics. Yeah. So, actually my wife and I were talking about this, and we're saying how one of the events we're looking forward to, they introduced this last Olympics, is they introduced a mixed relay, where it's the usual, you know, the usual relay with the fly, the breaststroke, the backstroke, and the freestyle, but it's two men and two women competing. So, and it's not a, and they can put whoever they want in the pool. So you have, right. And I was like, it was really cool to watch, because it's like, it's not just, you know, with the relay, you choose your person who is going to be the best at whatever stroke, right? But at the same time, now you have to strategize you have an extra.
A little bit of strategy, yeah,
So that stuff makes it really, really fun to watch. They've been doing a lot with sports. And speaking of which, do you have any that you, just automatically when the Olympics comes on, like you're absolutely waiting to watch? And do you have any that are just kind of like that are beyond the ones that are the normal ones, I guess the marquee ones? Are there any like kind of niche sports or something that you will tune into and find fascinating to watch?
You know, for the most part, I like to think when it comes to sort of the athletics and sports that I can watch excellence in any sporting event. I will admit that field hockey and table tennis really challenge that feeling of mine. I don't think I've made it through more than 10 minutes of a field hockey match, but it is, it's almost easier to name the Olympic sports that don't interest me or intrigue me. Olympic basketball has never really been a fan of mine since the Dream Team, although the way that sport has grown internationally has made it a lot more competitive and thus more interesting.
True.
You know, but the team sports, softball, and I kind of like the international baseball is a fun version of that, you know, sport that we're all used to. I mean, I'll even watch water polo, cause it's compelling as an Olympic setting, but I may well rearrange my day around the archery finals.
Oh.
Because that is so awesome on TV. That is so cool. It's so darn compelling on TV. Most of the track and field I enjoy, especially like the combo decathlon and heptathlon.
Yeah.
I even enjoy a lot of the equestrian, okay, not the dressage so much, but, but the other ones, you know, swimming can be a little hard to watch because it's tough to know exactly who is who, you know, just by watching it. But I will watch Katie Ledecky swim anytime, anywhere.
Yeah. Diving can be fun too.
Yep.
And such. No, I'm with swimming. I mean, I think the ones that get the most primetime coverage in the summer and in the winter, I tend to watch anyway. So the swimming, the track and field, obviously. I love watching the 100-meter dash. Because that's the
pure speed.
Yeah,
pure
speed. It's just like, and I think Usain Bolt still holds the record for that. So that's another one that's going to be tough to beat. And you know, the gymnastics gets like the huge spotlight every year. You know, so we'll watch that. I actually do like watching table tennis because it's crazy.
It is. I mean, it could be, you know, basically, someone described it. I heard, you know, the table is, you know, basically the size of your dining room table.
Yeah.
But the two players are standing, you know, at the neighbor's house on either side of it.
Yeah. This isn't how we played when my friends and I used to get together in their basement and like play ping pong and, you know, watch MTV on the weekends and stuff like that. So, and they're like, and they sweat like crazy too. That's
the other thing. Yeah. Yep. But you know, at this point with the two of us and the jobs that we have, we are not necessarily limited to what they give us in prime time.
That's true.
And anymore. So, you know, and this is just about my favorite potential time zone.
Mm-hmm.
for an Olympics because you wake up, you know, it's noon or one in the afternoon in Paris. You know, you can have, you know, it's, you know, basically the breakfast at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
You know, time frame. You wake up, there'll be live sports until I'm ready to go to bed. It's kind of perfect, perfect in that sense. So, you know, if it's an Olympic event, they say 80% chance I'm probably going to want to watch it, whatever it is. I'm just hoping that they can put like dressage at like noon so I can know that'd be a good time to go out and grab a lunch.
Yeah. If there's a, if there's something beyond the primetime coverage, that is, not something that like they probably will cover at all in primetime, I'll take a look at it. So it might be some of the martial arts stuff, you know, the Taekwondo, the right. Judo and stuff. Fencing is always fascinating to watch. Sometimes wrestling and weightlifting, like, you know, I'm not the biggest boxing fan. So I'll check that every once in a while, but yeah, I don't think I've really watched much dressage. And I think the only time I ever really actually actively watched the equestrian event, aside from when I was a little kid, when I was a kid and my sister like insisted on watching it because she's a horse girl, was 2021, because one of the competitors on the U.S. Olympic equestrian team is Jessica Springsteen, the boss's daughter.
That's
so it's like that was kind of cool. It's like I'm just kind of curious about that. So yeah, I'm kind of the same way.
Equestrian really is, you know, a blue collar, you know, working man's sport. So I think that's perfect.
I don't know. I give him and Mellencamp and Billy Joel and some of these others a pass because, like, knowing their backgrounds, like, they earned the giant house that they bought. Okay. Like, you know, so if his daughter's like going to take advantage of the fact that she can afford equestrian stuff, it's like, you know, more power to you. Your dad came from serious poor upbringing. So.
Now let me ask you this, man. Our focus is on France and the Summer Games, and I would say in the Winter Olympics, it's pretty similar that I gladly watch almost any of those events.
Yeah.
You know, to me, you know, for the Winter Games, if you can give me a TV viewing day that includes curling, biathlon, women's hockey, maybe throwing a little bit of ski jumping, then all is right with the world for me.
Biathlon's the one with the cross-country skiing and the shooting, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I like that. I also like that the cross-country skiing, that really, really long one. It's essentially the equivalent of the marathon. I don't remember how many meters it is. That is always cool to watch because it's just like you watch these guys at the end of the these people at the end of the race, and they are just completely spent. It's just the easily one of the most toughest endurance challenges in sports.
Yeah.
And it's cool to watch. You know, I love curling. it's so soothing. You're just watching.
it's a winner, man.
And I'm a hockey fan anyway, and I do love Olympic hockey. I've loved it since I was a kid, and they integrated pros into it back in the late 90s. But the difference was that when you had the Dream Team in 92, they dominated.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a foregone conclusion. It was almost like watching the Harlem Globetrotters. I mean, nobody was going to beat these guys.
Yep.
But when you bring pros into
– wasn't it for Angola the first match?
I think so.
The first game they played. Oof.
I think the only team that had a chance of giving them even a bit of a challenge was Lithuania. And Lithuania themselves are kind of like – they had like the Grateful Dead inspired t-shirts and stuff. They were kind of the darling of the non-dream team. When they did with hockey, though, it was much more competitive because so many hockey players in the NHL are from countries other than the United States. So
and it's not just Canada.
Yeah,
I mean, it's this Czech Republic and the Scandinavian countries,
and
the
Russians and such. Yeah. So it made it just as competitive. And then so it's always cool. And of course, the marquee thing in the Winter Olympics, at least as far as the American coverage of it, is the figure skating competition, both men's and women's pairs. To a certain extent, ice dancing is something I never really got that into. We might watch it just because it's on, but we'll get into the figure skating stuff probably a little bit, because I want to say that because of, at least for me, coming up in my formative years, because of some of the figure skating stories. That's why how much I know about the sport.
Right.
Whereas I don't know how much these days teenagers watching the Olympics and things like that, if they do that, would know figure skating on the level that, you know, we would, those of us who were like in the 90s and stuff.
Now, one of my favorite stories, it must have been before they did the pros in hockey, was, and this is just the nature of the way Olympics works with the nationalities that, you know, you can, that are, you know, available for folks. Mm-hmm. I remember, I don't remember, 88, whenever it was, sometime, long ago, there was a, I was watching the hockey, and there was an Irish hockey team. And, you know, it's not exactly Jamaican bobsledding, but it's pretty close. It's pretty close. And then you sort of, you dig in just for a second, and oh, this is a semi-pro hockey team from Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's from Boston. Oh, gotcha. Two generations back. Hello. They count as the Irish. As the Irish hockey team.
We got a lot of that in Athens in 2004 with the Greeks, because people who could claim enough Greek heritage were eligible for the Olympic team, which is fine.
That's fine.
As long as it makes it competitive. So you mentioned, obviously, seeing the Miracle on Ice and some other things. Any like when we talk about – We go back and we start thinking about like the Olympics that we've watched, who stands out to you that you've either just like are so memorable, or people that you've rooted for, moments that you particularly like absolutely love?
Before we get to individuals, mm-hmm. let me go off the board and ask you a weird question. This is just going to be about the sports in general. And because, you know, this is something I've spent way too much time thinking about. And if you just had to pick blindly, I mean, we're not knowing the specific athlete, mm-hmm. but if you had to pick an event with a gold medalist who would be on your, are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Zombie apocalypse survival team. Now, let me give you my answer and then, you know, give you a few minutes to think about this one. But, you know, for the winner, it's easy. And we've already talked about it. This is the easiest question ever. You can, yes, hanging out with the Canadian curling team would be a blast. Uh-huh. It would be a fun way to end your life, but you wouldn't survive. I mean, let's be honest. You want to hang out with the biathlon gold medalist because first off, you know, they can shoot. But, and I'm not necessarily saying the zombie apocalypse has to be in, you know, in another ice age. But if it does, you're going to want to be hanging out with someone equally proficient at the rifle and the cross country skiing. And I know, Tom, known you a long time. You and I probably have differing views on applying the Second Amendment in different contexts. But trust me. This is a case where you want someone good with a weapon, okay?
Yeah. No, that was actually my – I picked my
– And just even if it's not winner, those cross-country – I mean, you're not going to find anyone in better shape than a cross-country skier.
Yeah, it's the combination of endurance and that skill. So you need at least a sharpshooter.
And what I love about the biathlon, they always say, you know, the hardest part is your cross-country skiing – and then you have to stop. You have to get your hands to not shake.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get your pulse down. You have to – so they're like – they can be like calm, cool, and collected also.
That is true. That is true. And that was actually my pick as well. You know, you would need somebody with diversity, versatility in terms of sport. The only other, if you're gathering a team of people together, I'd probably grab somebody who is a good long distance runner as well. Because that could be your supply person, you know, and your archers and things like that could help as well. I mean, there's a practicality to that, but yeah, the biathletes, it's just fascinating to watch it to begin with. And I'm like, you know, and the other thing is that, you know, they're shooting with I don't know if that's a 22 or what. It's just a rifle. It's a hunting rifle. So it's not a semi-automatic weapon. It's not an automatic weapon. It is a one shot, and you have to, you know,
You have to hit it.
And
the punishment of having to go into the penalty box, the little extra mini loop of skiing you have to do. It's like, oh man, aren't I skiing enough already? I've got to go another, 300 yards or whatever it is. You're just killing me.
Yeah. Well, and if you think about it, in the zombie apocalypse, you're only going to have so much ammunition to begin with. And it's not going to be the easiest thing in the world to get more ammunition if you need it. So having somebody that has enough accuracy to get the shots that you need to get in the moment you need to get it is a really good person to have on your side. That's why I said, like, if you can get an archer who has some sort of similar thing, and that'd be another good person to work with as well. So yeah, we are pretty much on the same page.
For the summer games, I like in archery, you'd think decathlon, but I like it's actually one of my favorite events just because of the weird mix, the modern pentathlon, cross country running. So there you go, and it's not just on a track, right? Cross country running, swimming. Equestrian, I think it's jumping. Fencing, come on, fencing. And our old standby, I actually think it's a pistol shot in that one. But, I mean, those are five valuable resources as well.
Oh, that is awesome, yeah. Now I'm picturing like some sort of... picturing the opening to The Spy Who Loved Me, except with zombies instead of specters. So.
But back to the question you asked about 10 minutes.
Yeah, a favorite athletes, or as well, let's kind of combine them. Like, we'll talk about our favorite, the games that we kind of hold most in our memories or we consider favorites, and then as well as just some favorite athletes. We'll save the like individual moments for later.
Mentioned her a couple of times, but as I always say, the woman who put the figure back in figure skating, Katarina Vitt. Oh boy, that is my shag moment of the episode. But was it the discus, Al Order? He did like five Olympiads or something crazy like that. There's that. It's maybe more in the marketing side, but remember old Dan and Dave? The Catholics, only one of them made the team.
Yeah, which was so
a bit of a problem. Is that McDonald's?
It was Reebok.
McDonald's or Coke?
It was Reebok.
Gotcha. So, oops, yeah, no wonder Nike overtook.
For those who aren't familiar, it was a Reebok campaign, and they had Dan. I think it was like Dan O'Brien and Dave Johnson were the names of the people, and there were two decathletes competing to get on the Olympic team. And so they just ran this ad campaign where it was like, are you rooting for Dan or Dave? And like, they were just kind of these clips where they would ask people and they'd say Dan, Dave. So it was this whole thing. And the assumption was that they would be competing in the Olympics against one another, and that would be their huge big ad thing. And it was being successful for a little while. And then O'Brien made the team. Dan made the team, I believe, and Dave did not. And it just kind of fizzled from there. So you have to be it's Reebok's version of the McDonald's get a free meal anytime the U.S. medals in the 84 Olympics, which they parodied on The Simpsons. So Greg Louganis comes to mind. It's just you want to talk about like Summer Olympics and artistry and skill and stuff. Like, I mean,
wasn't there one of them where didn't he bump his head on one of the preliminary rounds, which is kind of like you're spotting everybody 50 points and say, don't worry, I can still win.
It was an 88. It was the springboard. He clipped the back of his head on the springboard, kind of coming out in a, I think he was spinning at the time. And I think I remember watching it. I remember watching the replay. And if you watch it in real time, not slow motion, it's like, it's jarring because I remember hearing it, but it's just like, doesn't look, but he finished the dive. So it's not like he was knocked unconscious or anything, but the back of his head was bleeding. I mentioned Mary Lou Retton. And of course you have, you know, I do love watching Simone Biles compete. It'll be really cool to watch her this particular year because, you know, there's a big conversation about her last time around because she pulled out of the Olympics just prior to, I think it was just after the trials because we're in the somewhere along before things really, the competition really got going. She'd been doing vaults and she was saying that she got, and I remember the term she used, but it was basically a really bad,
the twisties.
And she's like, I'm pulling out. And there were a lot of, anytime, you know, this is what frustrates me about the media and then the commentariat in the media who think that they could actually do this when it's like you have no skill, you can barely get up and walk across the room. But there were like, you know, there were people who were coming down on her for, you know, the decision. But when you're reading about like what she was talking about and considering the level of what she was competing at and having a mental miscue or misstep or like that moment of nervousness, like in midair, could prove to have a disastrous injury. So it's just like when you know you have, when you know you're like, I can't, when you know that this is probably going to happen, you're going to end up with the yips in a way that it could be end your career. You pull out and compete. Of course, I don't think NBC was very happy, but we'll get to them in a little bit. But no, it'll be really cool to see what she can do. The footage I've seen of Mary Lee Retton was always like amazing. And Nadia Comaneci is another one.
Yeah.
I was not alive to I was not alive in 76, but it was the going back to that sort of stuff.
Comaneci was one even living overseas in 76. Certainly made the news. Mm-hmm. That was one. That was the sort of one story that broke through this gal just getting perfect 10 after perfect 10.
Yeah. And then it was really cool to watch Michael Phelps and that particular team. I think it was Beijing where he won the 8 medals. It was being treated as a foregone conclusion, but it was really cool to watch. And I do remember a lot of the swimmers over the years, people like Janet Evans and, of course, Katie Ledecky and such. Yeah. And then on the non-American tip, a few skiers and figure skaters that I remember when I going back and watching stuff about them, like Alberto Tomba, who is really more known,
right? Italian.
Yeah, the Italian is more known for his kind of like swagger than he was his skiing.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, an Italian.
Yeah. Johan Olaf Kloss, who was Norwegian speed skater and was just dominant in like 92 and 94. And then people like Bonnie Blair and. The names kind of pop out and some of them stay with you and some of them don't.
Yeah, I remember from downhill skiing, was it the Mayer brothers?
Yeah.
They're Phil and Steve, maybe?
Yeah. And then there was Bodie Miller and Peekaboo Street. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there was a whole swath of them in the mid 2000s. And especially
was on the speed skating side, was it Dan Jansen? Mm-hmm. Who kept spinning out.
Yeah, I'll get to him a little bit later.
It took him a while, yeah. So,
And my favorite, like, as far as games are concerned, I'm trying to figure out, like, what my all-time favorite summer games are, and I don't know if I really have one. I did really enjoy watching 96 in Atlanta, because I was home from college all that summer, so I got to watch quite a bit of it.
Yeah, that was one where the... Obviously, you know, the time zone is right for us. Summer, the being in the summer was right for us. And also the centennial aspect of it. It was such a big deal. I mean, to me, that's the McDonald's and Coca-Cola, Olympics as much as anything else. That was just a blitz.
Yeah.
Blitz of publicity and promotion.
Yeah. It was interesting too, as I was thinking about this, earlier today, and I don't watch enough television with commercials or pay enough attention to commercials these days to see if this is still the case. But I do remember when I was younger, so we're talking in the 80s into the 90s, where you would have McDonald's commercials, Coca-Cola commercials, Bud commercials, like, you know, whatever, the things that you usually see advertised on television. And it would be like, but they'd be like Olympic themed, and you have, they're like, we're the official partner of Olympic athletes and things. And they were so geared toward that 2 week window. And I don't know if we see them as much as we used to.
Yeah.
And I always look forward to those.
I wonder if you know, some of the networks don't want to promote what's obviously an NBC product.
That's a good point.
You know, I mean, even if it's a, you know, McDonald's ad on CBS, are they going to run the, are they going to run a Olympic themed, you know, is Disney going to run an Olympic themed?
That was a good point.
Yeah, I don't know how that works.
And for my money, by the way, the 94 Lillehammer games are probably for me the most memorable, for various reasons, but we'll get some of which we'll get to later, but I just remember those very, very vividly.
Back in 92 and 94, we had all day drop-in parties, you know, for that middle Saturday of those games, Albertville and Lillehammer. And just to clarify, when I say party, I mean hanging out with our middle class, mildly conservative church buddies. Just so you don't get the wrong idea of what party means, okay? But that one of the, I mean, the Olympics and the Super Bowl are really the only two times you have sporting events that have, you know, at least, you know, in the U.S. where the TV audience pretty much mirrors the population of the U.S. racially, gender wise, income, all that stuff.
Yeah, I'd say
so it's really the only chances you have to really do mass marketing.
Yeah, I'd say the NCAA men's basketball tournament is in third, but a slightly distant third there, because it is appointment television for a lot of people, especially that first
mostly
weekend.
Mostly degenerate gamblers.
Yes, that's true.
But still, I say with love.
So we're going to roll it. July 26th is when the Olympics start, and it always starts with the opening ceremonies. Like I said, I remember bits and pieces of the 84 opener. I've gone back and watched it since then. And there's been so many over the years, and there's certain moments I can pick out of opening ceremonies from both winter and summer. Like, what do you come to expect when you turn on the TV and watch the opening ceremonies?
I mean, the nice thing about the you can look at it either way. Nice thing about the summer games is you have more countries participating. So you get to see more countries. You know, the winter games are a little more specialized. Yeah. The advantage of the winter games, it makes for a little bit quicker viewing. But at Parade of Nations, a little bit shorter. But I use, like, the Olympics, you know, that those opening ceremonies. I use them in class, like, as a reference point. For talking about, like, international business in the context of, you know how many countries there are in the world? There are over 200 countries. Watch the Summer Olympics opening game, and you'll remember Andorra. Oh, yeah, I remember you. St. Kitts and Nevis. How can you be one country with an and? Don't get me started on Trinidad and Tobago. Lesotho, good to see you again. I mean, the Parade of Nations and what they're wearing is always fun. You know, something that is, you know, supposedly sort of part of their national gear, their national identity, or just the colors that you see. That's always fun. In terms of specifics of the ceremony, two memories come to mind. One of the more recent ones, London. Daniel Craig doing the 007
with the Queen,
production bit with the Queen. I mean, that was pretty great. But I don't think that's one people talk about. Barcelona in 92, it ended with a guy shooting a flaming arrow into the bowl to light the flame. Come on.
Yes. And
there are There have been impressive ceremonies since then, but I don't think anything has topped Barcelona 92.
Closest was Lillehammer because it was a guy holding the torches. He was ski jumping and ski jumped past the cauldron and lit the cauldron. And those two, they were right after one another. Yeah, and but bad. Since then,
yeah, not bad.
people remember 96 in Atlanta mainly because Janet Evans came into running into the stadium and passed it off to Muhammad Ali.
Exactly.
And nobody was expecting Muhammad Ali. But no, I vividly remember that Barcelona opening ceremony. That's one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
And it was just so alive. I mean, the whole ceremony was it was so Spanish. It was so alive and colorful and fiesta and full of life. It just from that, I mean, obviously other ones have used technology as part of the, you know, on the floor, you know, those sorts of things. But I think for pure spectacle, I'm still going to take Barcelona.
I will say one of the ones I remember really, really vividly were the opening to the 2008 Beijing Summer Olympics, where you had this drum number. It was hundreds of Chinese drummers. And that was just an image that just came to define that moment, because it was just massive. I expect to I look forward to the ceremony mainly because, especially when it's in another country, because it can showcase something about that country and their current day culture that I might not know.
It's cool in some cases, you know, sort of who's going to be the flag bearer, mm-hmm. like sort of like who's their leading, you know, miscellaneous country so and so, and it's the, you know, person who's been, you know, their luge runner for the last 3 years, you know, three Olympiads, and he gets the honor, or the hammer throw, you know, guy from, you know, miscellaneous, you know, Bulgaria, or, you know, miscellaneous Middle European, you know, let's just say big man, who is, you know, the hammer throw champion of so and so, you know, whatever it is, he's, you know, smaller, you know, less well-known sports and countries sometimes get that little bit of publicity. Yeah,
and some of the bigger countries, or at least the countries that like European and Canadian American, what they're wearing is always interesting, because, like, for instance, Ralph Lauren has had the contract to design the American opening and closing ceremony outfits for decades now. And some years they've been really cool looking, and some years you're just like, what is this? And then there's always, like, I know the Canadian ones from a few Olympics ago were like the talk of everything. And then Italy, France, like, sometimes there will be some weird fashion choice because they had a designer do it. And it's just like, it's kind of a disaster, and it's kind of, you know, it's fun to watch from that point of view. I've always loved how you have the nations enter separately in the opening ceremony, and they do it in alphabetical order in French.
Right,
That's right.
So it is fun. It does vary, because sometimes we're in the U, sometimes we're in the Estados Unidos.
Yeah, so it's alphabetically by the home country's language, but they give it out in the home country's language. They announce it in the home country language, English and French.
With Greece going first.
Greece going first and the host country coming in last. But in the end, I love the closing ceremony, how they just all come in. And that's that whole spirit of the games, the idea that you are coming in and competing with one another, but there's a fellowship. And I think that gets you know, we have a very competitive sports culture in this country, which can reap some really, really great moments in every sport that we have, but it also can get very toxic. And the idea that the sportsmanship and fellowship and things and competition that's healthy and not, you know, nasty, it's always good to be reminded of that.
Right. But it's, you know, but it's great for the athletes, you know, from Thailand, mm-hmm. who know they aren't going to win a medal, but you know, whatever the qualification was, they met the international qualification to run the marathon or to, you know, whatever it was. And so that's that, you know, that's the honor. It's for the less competitive countries in terms of, you know, not the attitude of competition, but the, you know, the ones who walking in those, walking in that ceremony, that is the medal.
Yeah. Well, and
right, that's the
you benefit. Talk to some of the American and other athletes too, especially American ones, because a lot of the competitions that they're in, they compete on the world stage, but so much of it is on the national circuits. And a lot of these athletes are, you know, they're college students, in the case of gymnastics, or in high school. And you have people in their 20s and some in their 30s, depending on the sport, of course. But it's almost like they're studying abroad, and they find it. you listen to them being interviewed, and they're like blown away by how much fun it is to meet people from other countries and trade things and stuff. And they're like kids. And I always find it interesting when you hear about a certain high profile athlete not attending one of the ceremonies because they have to practice or something like that. And I get the need to be, want to be competitive, and you need that and whatever, but it's kind of a bummer, you know, be, you know, like enjoy, you know, like enjoy the experience for what it is as well. And I'm not a coach.
But you do like hearing the stories of the athletes from, you know, whatever country who, you know, their event wrapped up on day three of the Olympiad, but they stay the rest of the time, hang out in the, or attend, you know, go to attend other events. You know, the person in the village that they became friends with, they'll go to the table tennis to cheer them on from another country. Mm-hmm.
It's
whatever that is. I guess it's going to be on the mostly on the more amateur athletes who do that, but not necessarily. Yeah. Not necessarily. You'll see some of the basketball players and some of the other well-known athletes attending other events, and I think that's always.
Yeah, fun. It is. And if I were an athlete, I totally do that. If I were able to get that time to go to, because it's just, you're right. It's like, when the heck am I going to get the chance to go see badminton or handball or something? Now we talked a little bit about, hit a little bit on this, and we will get into it, which is the coverage. Up until about 1988, I think it was 1988, for many years, ABC was the primary network for the Olympic Games. Jim McKay, who notably got his bachelor's degree from my alma mater, undergrad alma mater, Loyola College of Maryland, was the anchor. He would, you know, so the way the network set things up is that they have obviously your play by play and your commentary teams, as any sport will. So for instance, you know, Al Michaels doing the play by play famously on the Miracle on Ice in 1980. And then very much they usually will have former players or former Olympians come in and do the, of color commentary for the sports, whatever it happens to be, kind of like how John McEnroe and Chris Evert do tennis nowadays, you know, as TV personalities. But you have an anchor, in the sense that there's a broadcast headquarters, and, especially with the primetime coverage, they will have that person anchor it and send it out to various places. Jim McKay was that for many years on ABC. And then it got passed along to NBC, bought the rights to the Olympics in around 88, at least the summer games in 88. And then by 94 and 96, they had both. I think CBS had it in 92, the winter. Anyway, point being, eventually Bob Costas became the Jim McKay of the Olympics. And now I think it's Mike Tirico who's handling it. When NBC broadcasts it now, they have, the whatever coverage they can have on network when they don't have to break for news or air soaps or whatever, you know, whatever's available at that time. But they also have, I think, USA, CNBC, MSNBC. They might have Bravo. I think they also might use Bravo. And I'm imagining they're going to use Peacock this time around.
Don't get me started.
So they'll air live events less segmented than you see on the primetime. The primetime will cut away to things here and there. The primetime is usually on a tape delay anyway. Because especially if it's like halfway around the world, because by the time you roll around to 8 o'clock at night, like for instance in Paris, by the time they roll around to 8 o'clock at night here, it's like one in the morning in Paris. So there's no competition going on, and it NBC's primetime coverage is so annoying.
I think part of that is because it's not going for a sports-themed audience. I mean, if you want the sports, you got to watch USA. Yeah. I mean, that's got to be your go-to because that's what the sports focused commentary. And was it ABC or NBC that the up close and personal was the branding on the when we'd go, you know, spend 17 minutes.
Yeah.
With miscellaneous pole vaulter and their family and those primetime segments, but you know, possibly it's my age, okay, or the nostalgia that comes with the age, or growing up as a child of Wild World of Sports when that mattered as a brand, but you know, for me, ABC is sort of always. In my heart, the home of the Olympics, even though it's been on NBC for three plus decades or something. But, you know, but Jim McKay is always, always the host. And, you know, which is not to denigrate NBC's talent at all. They have a ton of, you know, on-air talent from both their news side and their sports side. And so, you know, the Today Show, you know, will host some segments during the morning as well. During the day, and then like you said, the primetime coverage. So, you know, Katie Couric and, you know, Brian Gumbel have been there. Dick Enberg, probably, yes. You know, those names.
Dick Enberg.
The ones that come to mind. And so their coverage is solid. It's professional. It's technically competent, occasionally annoying. but it's, you know, sort of those, what do we say in sports? The intangibles. I always thought that ABC, you know, really brought the games, again, probably just nostalgia, but that's where my heart lies.
No, it's, and from what I remember in ABC, I always have a memory of it being more sports focused and less human interest stories. Yeah. And, you know, it's also, I think it's the prepackaging for the ratings so that they can get you to keep watching. So, when Phelps was going for his 8 golds in Beijing, they would put like, I joked with my sisters that they would keep announcing it like they announced Santa at the Macy's Day Parade, where like Santa's coming and it's like, you know, in an hour. But they would be like, Michael Phelps is going to swim in about 15 minutes. It's like, okay. The gymnastics tournament that actually ended 6 hours earlier and they're trying to keep you in suspense when everybody knows you could just go look up what happened. I knew that the U.S. women's gymnastics team had won the gold medal in 96 because I was at work and listening to sports radio. You know, they were broadcasting part of it and then they cut to the, you know, because I was waiting for the Mets game to start. But, you know, so I went home and I watched it. I was like, so I knew that they were going to win. So, but they're trying to get you to keep watching and I don't mind them flipping back and forth between events and things. I think what bothers me is some of the stories are really interesting when they do the look in at the person, the human interest piece. Some of them tip over way too much into schmaltz and it gets really, they don't know when to pull back on that. And because they're going for somebody in the audience who's not me, but the reason I'm watching is that you're not going to air this part of the competition on any other part. You know, in fact, I want to say that for the most part, they kind of shut down the rest of their coverage when the prime time comes around.
I think that's probably right. It's probably especially going to be this year because of that time delay. I mean, there's not going to be anything live. Wouldn't surprise me if I was going to say USA might have prime time by then. What they usually do with CNBC, I've noticed in the past, is obviously they do the stock market until 5 p.m. or 4:30, and then they'll cut and maybe do something till 8 Eastern. And one thing I've liked in the past is that they've taken the more niche Bravo and CNBC specifically, and they've been consistent with what they put there. I mean, I'm pretty sure one year CNBC just did curling. Basically, yeah. I mean, you know, during the weekday, it was the curling, a network or boxing. They'll do the boxing in the summer, you know, that sort of thing, where you sort of know, I flip over there after the stock market during the weekdays, and you sort of know what you're going to get. And I also give, again, you have to dig a little bit, but NBCOlympics.com has always been good about announcing what their TV schedule is going to be.
Check that out. Yeah.
Basically, within a half hour, an hour, you know, they can say, you know, we're going to show this final, this match. And obviously, if it's live, you know, things change. But they're pretty consistent with letting you know what they expect to. What they expect to air
and the cable networks are more likely just to sit on a game. If the basketball team is playing, and that'll be the game. You know, they're not going to cut away to track and field for a moment or water polo or something. Right. And we both watch a fair amount of sports that is just sitting and watching a game for a couple of hours. So we have the patience. Yeah. For that, but you know, it is more entertainment over on the main network. And the unfortunate thing is the marquee events and the things that go there. And I am really looking forward to seeing the women's gymnastics competition this year because I'm really interested in seeing how Simone Biles does. What I'm not looking forward to are the like 30,000 NBC stories about this and the mention of it every time she goes to the plate, so to speak. Yeah. And it's stuff like that. Cause sometimes they have like some sports have really good teams for, competition. For instance, finally after years of Dick Button, over on ABC, Johnny Weir and Tara Lipinski are doing, listening to them. Yes. And they're really, really good, but you get some people, my wife and I were joking the other day that Rowdy Gaines like yells if somebody just walks up to the starting line at something when we're watching swimming. So it's just like you have to kind of put up with it. But I actually think the opening ceremony coverage is some of the stuff that gets the worst because it is mostly the Today Show people and they over explain everything that's on the screen. And you're just like, shut up.
Let me watch this.
Yeah. Let's cut away from this to have an interview with somebody. You're like, no, I want to watch the ceremony. So, right.
Yeah. And now we talked about the dreaded P word, peacock, this year. Are you old enough to remember their earlier attempt at the pay-per-view? I want to say it was the gold, silver, and bronze packages that you could buy for pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. It must have been 96 or 2000.
I believe it was called
in those early days.
It was called the Triple Cast.
Yes.
It was kind of a disaster from what I remember is that people were not willing to pony – because pay-per-view was a big thing in the 90s.
Breaking news here, Tom. I never paid for any of that. I know. I
never did either.
It's a shock.
I remember the big things on pay-per-view when I was in junior high and high school were either boxing matches or WrestleMania.
That's right.
And I had – now, this is just like you and I and everybody else who's around our generation will totally understand this. People who are those millennials and those Gen Zers might not. My friend Rich had an illegal cable box. Remember those? And so we'd WrestleMania, like, we'd go to his place and watch it or whatever. And of course he got the porn, but you know, so I think he got the triple cast or something or whatever. I mean, I don't know if they'd cracked down on illegal cable with scrambling and stuff by 96 or whatever, but yeah, it was, and I think it was a lot of money too, from what I remember. Is it like, I think they realized that people are not willing to pay a lot of money for something that is, they really wouldn't want to watch, but they're going to watch on network and you're going to just watch it on. And I think that flipping it to cable when NBC the kind of bought up all those cable stations, because that's what happened as you went into the 2000s. There was this consolidation, and NBC oversees a bunch of them. That was probably the best bet on their part, because a lot of people still have cable, and those channels are basic cable channels. So you're already paying for them.
Right.
So Peacock, though, I don't know. I have to look. I haven't done any real research into this, and I'll have to see what they are going to air on Peacock and whether or not it will be on the free or the premium. I don't pay for Peacock because I just see what's available, what I can watch through my subscription through Xfinity.
Right.
And the only reason I remain shackled to Xfinity is that it's the best option in this area for both TV and internet. So
I wonder if they're going to do something kind of niche, like focus on one or two sports. Like if you want to watch every basketball match, every soccer match, you know, whatever that would be, and have it be, you know, the place where you can watch basically everything or every boxing, whatever it would be, you know, if they'll have do something like that, as opposed to just make it another general interest. Yeah. You know, sports show, you know, that doesn't make sense. If you're going to pay a little bit more for it, what are they going to deliver? But it's tricky. Do they go for the gold medal sports?
Yeah.
And, you know, so what you do.
Peacock as a service, by the way, is terrible. Like the interface, the interaction, the capability, it's just, it's like, it ranks down there toward the bottom of the billion subscription services I have. The other thing was, and this is something about NBC, this is going to sound like really, really cruel. Obviously, you're focusing on American sports in the prime time because that's what people want to see. But it's so overdone and overblown by like halfway through the competition, I'm actually rooting against us because I'm so sick of hearing it. I want to see like a completely different set of countries competing each other in an event that we're not dominating. And I have no problem with us winning. It's just that they overdo it as far as, you know, dominance in some sort of sports and stuff.
I'm glad you said that, Tom, because I didn't want to be the only one making this confession, but I don't always root for us either. It depends on the sport. Sometimes we're arrogant. Sometimes we're a little too cocky, but also sometimes look, if Malawi is going for their first bronze medal in 40 years, yeah, I'm going to root for them. Yes, I'm going to root for Trinidad and Tobago. I'm definitely going to root for Thailand. I'm going to root for a lot of these countries if this is their chance.
Yeah, or you're watching a certain sport. This happens in the winter a lot too, where you're watching sports like a bobsled or a luge or the biathlon or the big cross country marathon and stuff, where we're not competitive. You know, it's Norway, it's Italy, sure, and stuff. And then that's fascinating because of the fact that it's two countries that you are not invested in, kind of in the same way that, like, you know, I'm a huge New York Rangers fan. They lost. It didn't make me not want to watch the Cup Finals, which ended last night as we're recording this in June. I was openly rooting for Edmonton, and they lost. But it's just kind of cool to have – you're not completely invested in the team, but you're still rooting for – you're still picking sides and stuff, and you're enjoying the competition. And it's always cool to see just the way other countries play and stuff. So, but – yeah,
I will say this a little bit more on the winter side, but they're a nation that, you know, competes in both, and that's the, I have no connection whatsoever to the Netherlands, to Holland, but man, those bright orange Dutch outfits, They are noticeable. Oh, yeah. I'll give them that. Okay, orange. I can see from a distance. I am rooting for that Dutch.
And their national sport, I believe.
As opposed to miscellaneous red, yeah, white, and blue, they could be one of 25 different
exactly
countries.
And their, I believe their national sport is speed skating. So, yeah, so that's, yes, where it does get interesting. And you can hear – and that's where an NBC profile piece – on,
yes,
that country and how important it is serves its purpose, because then you're pulled into, okay, like, here's this guy or here's this woman or here's this team. Are they going to perform to what we've seen already? Because we're not watching water polo in the off season and stuff, yeah, like that. So, yeah, that's where I think you'd be. Now, kind of moving on from all that, NBC actually is going to be your realm of expertise and your favorite one, just the economics of all this. Now, we mentioned, yes, NBC, and we're going to get into some of the other stuff that doesn't have to do with television, but they do pay, like, it's like billions of dollars to get the rights to the Olympics, which is why there's such a push and such. And, you know, the sponsorships for years and years and years of the official this of the Olympics, the official that of the Olympics from companies is also to help the take some of the proceeds of that, and they would pay it toward athlete funds, because amateur athletes have to essentially pay their own way or raise sponsorships. But there's also the cost to there's two things I want to talk about. First, I'm going to talk about the actual cost of the games themselves and the economic impact on the cities. And then we're going to talk about merch. Now, from what I understand, and I just did some just kind of cursory research, is that L.A. in 84 is essentially like the standard bearer for a profitable, successful Olympic Games. I think it was one of the most profitable, even if not the most profitable in history. The notorious one is Montreal in 76, which I want to say kind of bankrupted the city or whatever. And I know that when you have one of the things that L.A. did really, really well, which I think they're actually doing, because the LA has the Olympics in 2028. And one of the things they did.
Oh, and that traffic is going to be great. I'm positive that is going to just.
They really want to outdo Atlanta.
I'm going to gladly be 3,000 miles away from that. The traffic still might affect me here in Ohio. I don't know.
Well, what they did in 84, and they're probably going to do again, is they used a lot of existing buildings and structures and stadiums and venues for the venues. They didn't have to do a lot of construction. And this is one of the things that I know will set a lot of cities back, is that they build facilities for these games. And then what do they do after it? I don't know. Like, what's your take on whether or not the Olympics are worth it for a city to host beyond the coverage they get?
Yeah. Couple things on that. First, I love international soccer, and I hate the international soccer governing body called FIFA.
Oh, that
I love the Olympics. I hate the Olympic international.
Well, the IOC, the IOC, but, and FIFA are in competition to see who's more corrupt.
It is horrible. But to answer your question, it kind of depends what you mean by quote unquote worth it. In terms of pure economics, most of these are going to be money losers, but they really aren't about that. Or I should say, in the G7 nations, maybe they are about that. They are about making money. That's why Montreal was a disaster, and LA and Salt Lake City also made some money. That's why the focus is there, frankly, in the broadly, I'm going to use the phrase, the Western world or the G7 nations. But they really aren't about that. What hosting an Olympiad is about, and I would add other significant international sporting events to that list, it's about soft power. And it's about normalization, normalizing a nation. It's about that country and its leaders being able to show off to the rest of the world that they are, in fact, a significant, important nation, that they're big enough and competent enough to pull something like this off. Now, I honestly believe that the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, followed by that same city being awarded a Formula One race later in the year, it's actually a pretty cool circuit. They run past a lot of those Olympic venues. So, oh, I remember the building. Russia hosted a World Cup in 2018. I mean, that 5 years, I think all of that made Putin much stronger on the world stage post all of those international Olympic events. That would be 4 Formula One races, a Winter Olympics, and a World Cup. I mean, come on. I think that made him so much stronger in 2018 than he was in 2013 before all those events took place. It gave him legitimacy that he was lacking, or at least legitimacy that may have been slipping away from him. And that's why they call it soft power. I mean, it is power. And I think those events, I'm just talking about the Russian, they strengthened him, man. And we see the horrific effect that that has all had since then. And if you look at some of the countries that are hosting, again, World Cups, it's terrible. And, you know, and the problem is I'm a fan of sports. I watch LIV Golf. I'm sorry. I know it's Saudi money. I watch, you know, there's going to be a World Cup in Qatar in a couple of years. They're moving it to the quote unquote winter, right? In Qatar, because it'll only be 105 degrees. They claim they're going to build indoor air conditioned stadiums. The most recent World Cup, or maybe was the Olympics, you know, the number of individuals who died, you know, building the stadiums, you know, the poor people who are shipped in to do this work. It's these organizations don't have consciences. Problem is, I love the stupid sports. That's the problem.
What you were talking.
I'm
overall the problem. What you're talking about soft power is, I know that was this what you could say for Putin, is what has been said about China hosting, especially exactly. Beijing a couple years ago. And you think of some other, like Brazil hosted Rio, and there's controversies that come with some of those hostings, whether it be the political standings of the countries themselves, or in the case of Rio, it's like Rio de Janeiro is a city that is gorgeous, but also has like a massive poverty and like a lot of sweeping that under the rug for the sake of showcasing, you know, what's great about the city in that sort of way. And I'm simplifying for the sake of brevity here, but also like a lot of, like you mentioned, the conditions in which people are working, or in the case of China.
I will correct myself. The Qatar World Cup has happened. That was 2022.
Yeah, is the next one in the Americas?
In the US. Yeah. But these international businesses and these international organizations, I should say. I mean, the reason they like, let's say, authoritarian countries is because that's where they get to do their business.
Yeah.
Right. And if you're doing, you know, if you got your Olympics in the U.S., you know, you're going to have those pesky U.S. rules and Freedom of Information Acts and all of that pesky stuff and journalism.
Labor laws.
you didn't have to worry about that so much in Russia or Beijing or some of these other places. Wasn't it Beijing? Didn't they shut down the country for 2 months beforehand so the pollution went away? So the air looked clear on TV. You know, that.
And there was also a lot of talk about protesting over human rights violations and things that are going on in other provinces in China that are far away from Beijing, and you know, no government is clean and such. So we do have that. A lot of that hangs over these things. So, but it is interesting to see that, you know, that the willingness to spend that money for that soft power or that showcase on the world. But along with that is, like, you obviously have the TV and you have, you have the spending of money on venues and things, some of which do get used. The main stadium for the 96 Atlanta Olympics was then converted into what became known as Turner Field, for the Atlanta Braves, which was just torn down a couple of years ago because they moved to yet a new stadium.
Which, to be fair, was probably, 25 years later. That's not a bad life for a stadium. For better or worse, that's not a bad life.
From what I understand, though, I think they're still going to use Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum for the opening ceremonies in the LA games because they still use it. USC plays there, from what I understand. So it's still – and that thing's been around for almost 100 years at this point. But there's, you know, tickets and there's merchandising. And, you know, there I have – very little. I can kind of run down really quickly what I own. My mom worked for AT&T for 30 something years. Mm. So she gave, would come back with, they were a big sponsor. We never got anything cool except like I have some pins that were just AT&T Olympic pins and stuff like that. So that was always really cool. I have, let's see, the album is called Summon the Heroes. It was essentially the official soundtrack to the 96 Atlanta games and had a John Williams track that still gets used on NBC today. Mm-hmm. So I had that on CD. I bought it when I saw it came out. And then a number of years ago on eBay for a very low price, I think with shipping, I think it was about $10. I got on vinyl the official music of the 23rd Olympiad in Los Angeles in 1984 record, which has a John Hughes theme.
Yeah.
It's got a really cool – it's got a couple of songs by like Foreigner and Loverboy. Vince DiCola, Toto is on here. Christopher Cross, Giorgio Moroder.
That is a 1984 time
It is. They're Herbie Hancock. Bill Conti, who is responsible, of course, for the Rocky theme, did a wrestling and what they call power sports piece called Power, which was really, really good. I remember focusing on it. And the cover is great. It's that really famous LA logo of the kind of the flying stars, red and white, blue and red and blue star, red, white, blue stars with the Olympic rings below it. And I'd always wanted that album. I used to see it in the, because, you know, we'd go to, there's a store in New York, the New York area called TSS, which was pretty much like a Kmart. And, you know, my mom would go in there for like whatever reasons, right? And my friends and I, we would either go to the toy section or the music section. And in the music section, we flip through like whatever we could find. And in the soundtracks, they had that cassette. And then they had the other one I always noticed was the one for Soul, because this was in the late 80s. So there was one for the Soul Olympics. And I remember the Whitney Houston song One Moment in Time was a huge hit. And that was sort of the, quote, theme, at least from the American side of things, for that. But you've got a lot more, and I believe you've attended Olympic events. So I wanted you to talk a little bit more about that than what I have here.
How about that? Well, I am going to hold off on that till we talk about our Olympic moments. But in terms of memorabilia, I do have one ticket. I do have one ticket, yes, for an event. And I remember having a 1976 Montreal shirt. And certainly when Atlanta 96 came around, just you couldn't avoid it. Any store you went to, any restaurant you went to, your things being given away. And I remember I tell this story in international business section. It must have been 96, but at one of the Olympiads, sounds like something the Americans would do. It sounds like something McDonald's would do. As a honor, the country post, you know, would put on the paper, you know, tray liner, and then the napkins would all have, you know, flags of different countries around the world. Which sounds great. The only minor technicality was, I don't remember if it's Saudi Arabia, but one Middle Eastern country has some words from the Quran on their flag. Yeah, and you know the idea of then, you know, crumpling, you know, using that to wipe up your Coke spill and then throw it out.
Yeah,
was on something that disposable was an inappropriate use of that, and they had to recall those particular flags. But you get the spirit behind it, I guess. You know, we'll plaster everything with flags of the country so you'd know what Romania's flag looks like versus Hungary's. versus the Czech Republic and whatever.
And I mean,
you know, sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, and if I were around and buying stuff and things like that, I saw this stuff. I'm a mark for that stuff. I'm a huge Epcot Center dork. Yeah. So, I get every once in a while I go on eBay just a curious. It's one of those curious. I never buy anything for this. I just kind of see what's out there because it's just kind of fun to see what was produced. There's some. Your very typical commemorative programs and books and right. T-shirts and posters, but then there's like you might know this because you might have had relatives like parents, grandparents, souvenir spoons and bells,
yes. Yes.
Stuff like that, ashtrays. Which,
right.
which I'm amazed anybody
I'm amazed
that ashtrays were manufactured in anything other than an elementary school art class in the 1980s. We were like a cottage industry for smokers, but yeah, ashtrays, like stuff like that. I love seeing that stuff pop up because like they would slap the Olympic rings on anything back in, especially in 1984. So it was always fun to see that stuff out there.
Yeah, but I don't think I have anything mm-hmm. currently. I have a few bits of Team USA gear, but I think it's might be the women's soccer team or something. I don't think it's okay. Olympic specific.
So before we are going to get to our five moments or so that we've chosen as far as favorites are concerned. But before that, there's one piece of sort of merchandise or associated media, which is film. And there's two things to talk about here. One is the documentary. The other would be the fictional or a fictionalization of certain events and things like that. On the documentary side, of course, you've got your million different human interest pieces over at NBC. But back in 1984, you have Bud Greenspan, who I think has since passed, has really pioneered the idea of the Olympic documentary. Or brought it into the 80s because the two high water marks for it previously were Leni Riefenstahl in 1936, which it's like, do I really want to watch the Nazi Olympic film? And then Tokyo in 64.
I mean, I am kind of curious how they cut around Jesse Owens. That would just be interesting.
If you want to look at anything about the 36 Olympics, there's probably a couple of other good documentaries. I'm sure that the American Experience, the PBS show, has something that is really worth watching. I think I've watched one or two of them, and that is because it's a really cool story of him and as far as that whole games are concerned. And then in 60 or 64, Tokyo hosted the Olympics the first time. And the documentary that came out of that is really good. A lot of these, by the way, are available, or at least at one point or another were available on Max. And so in 84, Bud Greenspan puts out 16 Days of Glory, which is, an Olympic documentary about the 1984 Los Angeles Olympics. And I remember renting it at the video store when I was a kid, and it was a 2-hour tape, right? It wasn't until it popped up on Max for streaming that I understood there was a 4-hour version. And what's cool about the Bud Greenspan films, and he did them for Seoul and Barcelona, and it's like all the way up until I think maybe the mid 2000s or so. I don't remember when he passed, but what's cool about them is that you don't have to sit there and watch them for 4 hours because he does them in segments. So he will do an entire segment of 20 minutes or so on these two downhill skiers who are competing with one another, or Carl Lewis or Mary Lou Retton or Katarina Witt or whatever. So you can watch it in segments and over several days, which is what I ended up doing. The quality of the film is great. The quality of the coverage is great. The interviews are really good. He works like purple prose and hyperbole in that classic NFL films sort of way. I don't remember who did the joke. It was probably like Bill Simmons or somebody. He said NFL films can make a 3-13 Chargers season look epic. and this is like Greenspan gives it this like makes it have this huge amount of gravitas, but without tipping over into schmaltz and syrupy stuff in a way. And some of the moments that he does focus on that are more emotional do actually hit you because he does it really, really well. Have you ever watched any of those?
I believe I've watched that the 1984 one. And I've probably watched a few others as the years have gone by. I found, though, that as the coverage of the Olympics grew and grew, and I consumed more and more of it as it happened, I kind of felt like I needed the documentaries less and less.
That's a good point. Yeah. You know? I found myself, when I'm watching them, more focused on the segments of things that I did not watch.
Yes.
So like that's where that big cross country race really piqued my interest as we go into the years and years now, because they would do a segment on them and I'm like, this is fascinating. And now I want to watch it live. So if it's like a weightlifter or somebody who I just didn't get a chance to see, that would be really cool. But yeah, if I don't need the Tara Lipinski profile, for instance, you know, or the Michelle Kwan one, stuff like that, because I watched that whole thing unfold. Yeah. Then you have movies, and you had messaged me with like a short list of them, the narrative ones, everything from Miracle, which was Kurt Russell as Herb Brooks.
Yeah.
Cool Runnings, of course, is one of the most famous.
Sure.
There's others. There's Munich, which does not involve the sports, but is Spielberg's. I believe it's about Mossad tracking down the people who perpetrated the murder of the Israeli athletes. Munich's a great movie, by the way. And I, Tanya, of course, from a few years ago with Margot Robbie as Tanya Harding.
Tanya Harding, yeah.
Which is.
And I remembered Eddie yes, the Eagle. Eddie Eagle. I thought of that one too. Eddie the Eagle.
One of my all time favorite sports movies from 1992. Is The Cutting Edge, which is a pair. D.B. Sweeney plays a hockey player who gets an injury and he can't play hockey anymore. So he switches to, he ends up being a male partner of a figure skater, female figure skater played by one of my major 90s crushes, Moira Kelly, and Terry O'Quinn, who was, Lost is her father. It's half of a sports movie and half of kind of like they hate each other, but they all end up falling in love, romantic comedy. Yeah. It's such a great movie. Moira Kelly yelling toe pick over and over and over again. It's
just... I mean, just sports. I mean, we know the sports by its nature has that dramatic element to it. I mean, it has that competitive element to it, and it leads up to a big finish. It leads up to a big event. There's a winner or a loser. It is perfect for drama. And especially if it's – even whether it's loosely based on reality or not.
Cool. I haven't seen Cool Runnings in a very, very long time, but I just remember it being very funny.
I watched I, Tanya last year. Oh, it's a great movie.
And I want to say Allison Janney won Best Supporting Actress for that.
Yes, yeah. I believe that's right.
Munich's outstanding. I actually never saw Miracle. I just never got around to it. And then I actually had one of my favorite sports documentaries is about the 80 hockey team called Do You Believe in Miracles? It was an HBO sports doc. So that's the thing I read. And then that's where I found out what Herb Brooks said to the team in the locker room during the Finland game when they were down. Have you ever heard that story? I put an explicit tag on this anyway. Mikey Rusignoni is telling the story, and he says he comes in, he just looks at us, he says, "You lose this game, you'll take it to your fucking graves." And then he says he starts walking out, he turns around, he goes, "Your fucking graves," and walks out of the room. And I'm like, that is balls out crazy, but it probably worked. And his thing was, I mean, Brooks's thing was that he had all the – they talk about it. He had all of these college players who were rivals with each other because they were playing for top colleges in the NCAA. And, you know, the Minnesota guys didn't like the Boston University guys, et cetera, et cetera. So he made them – he basically gave them a common enemy in him. And that's how he got them to bond with one another. and, you know, just reading. And then they interview the Soviet players in that documentary. I do really recommend it if you can find it. But so I might have to sit down and watch Miracle, because it strikes me as something as good as like Hoosiers, which I love Hoosiers. So. But you're right. They're a good sports movie is always, you know, the underdog story is always great, right? And Miracle certainly has that. You know, it's the U.S. college, plucky U.S. college team against the Soviet machine. And it's literally what happened. You don't need to fictionalize it too much for to see that narrative play out. And then you have, like, you know, the individual stories and things like that. They don't always have to win. Sometimes it's the emotional victory and things like that, kind of the Rocky of it all. And other times, yeah, they do win because you want them to win and stuff like that. But it also touches on some of our national pride for things like that too, when they're very focused on that in a way that can be genuine and can also be like just very Rocky IV. So our last segment today is going to be our like five Olympic moments that stand out to us, or top things that we like, all-time favorites. So I will let you start with your first one, and then we'll kind of alternate until we finish up.
Yeah, I think I interpreted this correctly, meaning things from our lifetime. Yes. So I got no Jesse Owens, no Jim Thorpe. I mean, I'm a little bit older than you, but let's not get ridiculous. So yeah, again, we've talked about a couple of these already. Number five for me, you know, counting down Casey Kasem style, I'm going to go with the Barcelona opening ceremonies, because I mean, even before we talked about that, I think about that archer shooting that flaming arrow, I don't know, a couple times a year. That's just in terms of Olympic, when you mentioned Olympic memories, that is one of the things that first came to mind for me.
For me, number five is, it is just kind of a tie between just watching Michael Phelps and Katie Ledecky. Just because that is NBC overdid it with Phelps, and they are overdoing it with Ledecky a little bit, but it is appointment television to watch their races, even if you're not sure they're going to win. And I'm not usually the type of person who just loves to watch dominance in sports, because to me it gets boring after a while, but it's just astounding how athletic those two were and how much they get the field to get up to compete at their level too. And I think that's another thing about somebody like that that's really, really cool. So I'm really going to enjoy watching, Ledecky, and, a lot of the women swimmers are really, really good as well. Many of whom are from.
Yeah.
The University of Virginia. So, wahoo! All right, you're number four.
You know, I'm calling an audible, because number four was going to be not just Do You Believe in Miracles, but the fact that Jim Craig and Arruzioni and the guys had to then play another game, because that was the semifinal. They had to beat those. They had to finish the finish. I remember that slogan. They had to finish a few days later. So I'm bumping that. I'm replacing it with one of my honorable mentions, which was Carrie Strug in that last vault on that injured ankle.
I do remember that
from that one. So that one, that's going to be.
Yeah, you want to talk about a movie moment?
That's my one for there. Yeah, yeah. Made pure Olympic drama.
My next one, I've mentioned him already. It is Usain Bolt winning the 100, especially in Rio. I think it was the 100 in Rio, where you have that picture of him just kind of like smiling at the camera and like holding up a number one or whatever. It's just, again, the dominant athlete, but it's the guy was fun as hell to watch. And then it's just setting a standard for a record that like people are going to keep chasing and chasing and chasing. So you're kind of hoping somebody will break that record, not because you hate Usain Bolt, but because you just like to see a record like that fall, because it's such a hard record to break. And so that sets you up for some really, really interesting stuff, down the line. All right.
It was tricky on this one because I get how many ice skating things can I do? So we already mentioned Tanya and Nancy in passing. We mentioned Torvill and Dean. So I'm going to go back to my one that I thought of a little bit later. And I did have to look up the details for this one. I knew the basics of the story, but his name is Derek Redmond. But he's mostly known as that runner guy who hurt himself and his dad came. So it's the British runner, Derek Redmond. He, you know, popped a his hamstring went out on the final turn. It may have been the 1500, something like that. And his dad comes out of the stands. Mm-hmm. And together they sort of limp themselves across the finish line. No, Tom, those are just a little dry in here. It's the pollen. It's the dust. Okay, that's all it is.
I remember that very, very vividly. And that was such a great moment. That is one of those, like, this is the Olympics type of moments for you too, that goes beyond just the winning and stuff. My number three is actually the Nancy Tanya because it was such
drama.
A junior in high school. I remember, like, it was on tape delay because it happened hours and hours earlier. They were airing it in prime time, and my dad actually knew one because he'd been listening to the radio, but he didn't tell us. And, like, I watched the whole thing. So, like, that's where, like I said, the fact that I know so much about figure skating, women's figure skating especially, comes from that. And even prior to that, like, 92 with Christy Yamaguchi and then Michelle Kwan for years trying to get trying to get the gold medal and stuff. But the Nancy Tanya thing, just the tabloid nature of it all. It was one of like four or five stories through the early to mid 90s that were tabloidy, that were like in the national conscience in a way that we don't get as much now because of the way the media has splintered so much and stuff, where it's become very kind of dark in a way. But like you have where I come from, you have the Amy Fisher story, and then you have like Loretta Bobbitt, and you have OJ later. You have Nancy and Tanya were like right in there. And it was just how the things surrounding that, the story behind it, these idiots. and then I, Tanya being a very, very funny movie in that way. But it's just,
yeah.
All right, you're number two.
This was the number one ice skating story. So I had to, this is the ladies program from Calgary, 1988, the Battle of the Carmens, in which my all time Olympic girlfriend, Katarina Witt, won the gold over Debbie Thomas, with both of them skating to either the same exact piece of music or different selections from Bizet's All the Drama. And because it was Calgary, amazing.
I believe the silver medalist was a Canadian woman. And that also, this isn't my moment, but just to add to that, that was also the men's figure skating was the Battle of the Bryans, Boitano and Orser. And that was also a really good
competition. That's right.
So Calgary had some really good figure skating. My number two is very recent. It's from the 2022 Beijing Games, and it is in the mixed snowboard cross relay. So mixed snowboard cross relay, you start at the top of the hill. There's a course to go down. You are snowboarding against like two or three other people. So you're all in a line, just like you would in a race.
Oh, yeah. That is a great
And it's a mixed. And this is the mixed competition where like you had a pair of a man. Man and woman. This is Nick Baumgartner and Lindsay Jacob Ellis. And Baumgartner was like 40, and Jacob Ellis was like a veteran by then. It was their last Olympics. And they came really from behind, and they were not expected to gold, and they did. And the reason for me this is so memorable, aside from the fact that it was a great race, it was that it was live on NBC because of the 12-hour time difference. So they couldn't package it the way they do everything else, and they had to call it live. And we're watching it, and it was this genuine moment that nobody could see coming. And it was just amazing to watch. And I still remember them just calling it like they had to sit back and be sports for a moment because it was in prime time. It was so cool to watch. And it was a really, really cool race too, because it's just so fun to watch that.
I love it.
your number one?
The story you hinted at before. This is second night, 1984, the last match of the preliminary round robin group stage for men's soccer. France won, Chile won. And, you know, you may be wondering why my favorite Olympic event was a soccer match that ended in a tie. Punchline first is that I happen to have attended that soccer match. So I have been to an actual Olympic live and in person. But let me tell the story. Tell you a little bit about my late who passed away in 2022. He was one of those people with jobs and kids and cars and houses and mortgages and lawns. We just had a lot more to talk about. He was much better relating to us as adults than he was like kids and adolescents and teens. But what we did have in common growing up was we both, and at that time he had season ticket known as Redskins football team. And every year, two or three take me to a game, or we went to an NBA All-Star game at the Capitol Center, 81, 82, 83, something like that. Baltimore once a year for an Orioles game. But the one sport that man could not abide was soccer. I said before, I lived 3 years overseas, and every other country other than the U.S., soccer is a big deal. So I played the game a little bit over there, but I really became a fan of it. So we returned from Thailand, and I did convince him once or twice to take me. Remember the Washington Diplomats, no. Tom? North American.
This is the same league. Was it the same league as like the New York Cosmos?
Yes. Yeah, that era, that league. And of course, I mean, my dad found it pretty unbearable. But he did it. Let's just say he was glad that when I got old enough that I could navigate the DC Metro by myself, so he didn't have to go to those games. Back to the Olympics. Soccer is one of the competitions where the host nations, they spread out the venues across the country. We're talking 1984, the LA games, but the soccer matches were spread throughout the country. And there's a weird thing about soccer, and this is very dated to the 80s, but a soccer field has to be perfectly flat. That makes sense. Yeah. You're rolling the ball. Has to be perfectly flat. Well, it doesn't seem like that should be a big deal. And this is the story that I was told. Like soccer and football, basically, the fields are basically the same dimensions. So you'd figure you just find a football field and play soccer on it. And these days you can. But in the mid-80s, the state-of-the-art way of handling drainage, water runoff, was that the fields were actually tilted just a little bit towards the edges. Oh, I'm talking 100 yards of it. The fact that the end zones might be 3 inches in the 50-yard line is not a big deal. It's a big deal for soccer. So in 84, again, nowadays, technology of drainage is so, you know, that this is not an issue anymore. All of this is to say that for some reason, one of the few places that Olympic level soccer could be played in the mid 80s was the Naval Academy in Annapolis. So my dad, despite his feelings, he did get us tickets. I showed you the picture. I don't know if you noticed. $11. Oh, $11, Tom. Even with inflation, I think it's like $30.
Which is like now it's probably a few hundred.
It got to be hundreds. Yeah, $11 to attend an Olympic event, and to say it was one of the nicest presents the man ever got for me because he hated soccer, but I got a great memory and I got a cool story.
I can't beat that. But my number one is my number one. I remember watching this on TV and really, really feeling it because I've been watching this guy since 88, which was Dan Jansen, the male speed skater. He competed in 84, which I don't remember, but he competed in 88, 92, and 94. And the thing that he was most famous for was falling. And the first race he fell in, his sister had like just passed from leukemia, like that day or day before or so. And he was running and he was favored to win these races. It's not like he was just like, just happy to be there. So he kept falling and falling, and then he didn't place. And in 94, he finally won, and it was like this. It was just – it was a very, very emotional moment. If you've been following for that long, it was just so wonderful to see. And the place, like – I just remember the place going nuts, and it's just one of those great, great stories that you remember. And even – I still feel emotional like when I watch the highlights of that. It's still so cool to see.
Yeah. All right. Other honorable mention I did one. Mention was any woman with Aboriginal ancestry, mm-hmm. I believe. You know, one gold medal in Sydney, and that was a major deal at the time that their sort of lead athlete was someone from the native That's population. Cool. So I remember that being a significant moment for. For Australia and for those Olympics.
All right, yeah, so that just about does it. Yeah, and we're both looking forward to watching this and seeing what happens with the games this year. Before you go, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you?
Well, as this episode is being released, you can find me in front of my TV. Hopefully not in front of Peacock, but anyway. Well, thank you, Tom, for having me. Always appreciate it. Most of our work is comic-related. The Room Speak and also the Quarterbin Podcast. Our most popular show, The Occasional Short Box Showcase.
Yeah, and that's all that relatively geeky.
Yes, thank you.
And if you have anything you want to share about the Olympics, any memories, any questions or anything, feel free to send me feedback either here, Instagram, Blue Sky, Twitter, Facebook, wherever the heck we are these days. And as always, thank you very much for listening and take care.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is produced by me, Tom Panarese. All clips are copyright their respective copyright holders and no infringement is intended. This podcast is a part of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you can find at twotruefreaks.com. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps the show get noticed by other people. Feedback via email can be sent to popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com. For show notes and essays and other things random in the world of popular culture, visit popcultureaffidavit.com. You can also follow this show on Facebook at facebook.com/popcultureaffidavit and on Twitter at popaff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F. Thanks for listening, and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.